Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of You Make Me Sick. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest. Taylor Rogerson is an acute care nurse practitioner. She is currently working in the medical intensive care unit at Boston Medical Center, and she is gracious enough to join us. I'm gracious enough to have her, and I'm glad that she's here today to kind of speak a little bit towards the nurse practitioner role, what she does in the ICU compared to what other nurse practitioners may be doing just kind of in other settings, and how kind of unique her role is, and give us a little background on where she is, where she came from, how she got here. And then if anybody is interested in becoming an NP, this might help guide them as well. If they're looking for, you know, something that's a little bit out of the ordinary when it comes to nurse practitioners. All right. So thank you for joining us today, Taylor. So I kind of want to get started. First of all, you're a nurse practitioner, but I know that you started out just as a registered nurse. And I was wondering if you might be able to give me a little bit kind of about your history, where you started, where you went to school, and then how you decided to become a nurse practitioner.
Sure. So I started about 10 years ago now. I originally did my undergrad at Endicott College, which is a college just outside of Boston, Massachusetts. And I did a four-year undergrad there. And then quickly while I was in school there, I learned a lot about myself, but also that I very much needed to be in the acute care setting to really feel like I was, you know, I had kind of found my place. And I'm always envious of nurses who have done a bunch of different stints and different types of units and gotten to learn, you know, OB and then going to ortho. But I very quickly realized that the place I felt most comfortable and most stimulated mentally and felt most at home was critical care. So I actually moved. At the time, there were no new grad programs in Boston. So I picked up at about 21 and moved to DC. I didn't know anyone there, but there was a new grad program for the medical ICU at Georgetown. I worked at MedStar Georgetown for about 3 years before deciding that I wanted to pursue my master's in acute care nurse practitioner. I did acute adult nurse practitioner. And with that, I ended up completing another 2 years while I was doing clinicals. I did travel nursing for 2 years in California. I figured, you know, now's the time. I'm not going to want to do that once I finish my master's. So I kind of did locums and per diem stints in various ICUs as a nurse while I finished grad school at Georgetown University. And then from there, I moved back home. So after about 5 years away, I came back to Boston. I took my first NP job, which was an acute care nurse practitioner at Beth Israel. And I was in neurocritical care, which was a completely new realm for me. I had never done neuro. The most I had done for neuro was during travel assignments. But I learned so much at that job, and it really, I think, made me a better provider all around, especially in a medical ICU. You know, we can talk more about that after, but, you know, patients are so sick in the medical ICU. I think oftentimes they're sedated and other things are going on, and we don't realize or, you know, give the brain as much attention as it needs because so many things are happening. So I think it really opened my eyes and expanded my care. I'm very grateful for that, but it was just, again, not my home. My medical ICU has always kind of been where I feel most at ease, which is kind of ironic because it is a fast pace, but it's the place where I feel most fulfilled. So when the job came up at Boston Medical Center, after 2 years at BI, I moved over to BMC, and I'm in the medical ICU there now, and that's where Andy and I work together. So that's kind of a long, torturous route, but each piece definitely filled some hole or some knowledge gap to kind of get me to where I am now, which is, I would say, probably the first job I've had that I feel still challenged every day, but kind of more as in I'm hitting my groove and, you know, a decade worth of work has kind of gotten me to where I wanted to be. And it's a pretty satisfying feeling.
So when you were when you had first started out nursing, did you know immediately that you wanted to obtain your nurse practitioner, or was it something that after a year or two at the bedside, you were like, you know, I don't know if I can do this for 25, 30 years? Was it something that wasn't as fulfilling, or you wanted, I don't know, a little more autonomy in what you could actually do as a practitioner?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say I probably had a little bit more of the non-traditional route. I remember when I applied to Georgetown, and I think times have changed now, but even 5-7 years ago, when I applied, I remember in my interview, they said, you know, if we accept you, you'd be the youngest acute care student we've ever had, and how will you navigate that? And I think a lot of people potentially use NP as, like you're saying, they go bedside, they do it for 5, 10, 15, whatever it is, years, and then kind of tire out and look for something different. I unfortunately, fortunately and unfortunately, knew from like the second year of nursing school that nursing wasn't going to be the end for me. Not because I didn't enjoy what I had learned, but I found that I was always wrapped up, you know, they wanted us to do the nursing care plans, and I was always wrapped up in the medicine and the pathology and how to treat things. And, you know, I ended up spending more time studying those than the nursing realm of nursing care. So I actually tried to switch into PA school after my sophomore year, but none of my credits were going to transfer. So that's when I kind of started to explore nurse practitioner. I also explored med school. Once I got to Georgetown in those first 2 years as a nurse, I took classes because I thought still I might want to go to med school. But I ultimately decided on NP for lots of reasons. Yeah, it was never an afterthought for me. It was very much every move I made, including moving somewhere I had never met anyone, was part of a bigger goal for me. I think there's lots of ways to get there, but I kind of knew early on that I wasn't going to feel fulfilled bedside as a nurse because I needed that pathophys. I needed to be able to, you know, think critically, and not that you don't as a nurse, but I liked the autonomy of making decisions. And so that quickly eliminated, you know, nursing as a lifelong career for myself.
Yeah, because as a nurse, you have the ability to make decisions on your own, but it's usually guided by physician's orders or protocols. So it's totally. there's a lot of kind of checking the boxes, and you can go, sometimes you want to go beyond that and learn a little bit more. And I can definitely tell from an early age, you kind of knew that that wasn't going to be enough for you. So,
yeah. And I think that the critical care piece of nursing is overshadowed often because I think for people not in the field, it's very much, you're the nurse, you're taking the doctor's orders. And I respect and indefinitely value the time I spent bedside because I think it not only helps me to discuss patients with nurses better, but I trust my nurses. You know, if you're telling me something's going to go wrong, you have those gut instincts, you guys have those experiences. And I think having been there and felt like, you know, whether it was my spidey senses or I'd seen that before as a nurse, or you're with the patient all day and you know way better than the provider who's in and out. I think that's something that sometimes our medical colleagues, you know, that are doctors and those things, it's not as natural that to them to just blindly trust their nurses. But having been there and felt like I really had been pushing providers in the past as a nurse and trying to tell them something was going wrong only for them to kind of ignore it or devalue, you know, that I'm supposed to be just following the orders is something that really hit home with me and something that I still every day in practice try to prioritize listening to nurses. And it's a team effort, you know, we're not there as providers every second of the day. The nurses are. And so I think there's just as much critical thinking and people reading even more so in nursing. But yeah, I think for myself, it was clear I was not, you know, once you see these outstanding nurses, you know, if you're going to be one of them. And you know, we have the nurses that are like cleaning between people's toes in their free time and, you know, doing their hair. And we need those people. They're amazing on top of doing critical care and other things. But I knew that wasn't really going to be my wheelhouse.
Yeah, so I think most people they're pretty well aware of what most nurses do. There is a lot of that, you know, almost tasky kind of work, you know, along with, you know, giving medications, interventions. I was wondering though if you could might help to explain to some people who don't know as far as what nurse practitioners, what their scope of practice actually is compared to that of an RN. You know, what kind of sets nurse practitioners aside just from a registered nurse who just has a bachelor's degree in nursing?
Sure. Yeah, so I think this is a pretty loaded question. There's a lot of parts to it in the sense that I kind of went into it thinking like, okay, there's just one way. You go to school, you get your master's, you do, you know, one of the many programs, and I can go through all of those. But there's a lot of state practice guidelines that change what your scope's going to be depending on what state you work in, depending on whether you're outpatient or inpatient. But, you know, the general school course is completing your undergrad. Typically, a lot of schools, again, I think in recent years, more schools allow you to go right from graduating as a nurse into school. When I was applying, you had to have a minimum requirement of, for mine, for example, 2 years in an intensive care setting. So you get that experience and then you apply for your master's. And there's several different ways you can go. So there's adult geriatric, and there for that category, you can treat anyone above, I believe, 16 years old, who is either an adult or a geriatric patient, but you are not qualified to treat anyone that's a pediatric patient. You can go into pediatrics and you can do acute or primary care for that as well. And again, in that case, you could work in that setting, whether that's acute or primary. And again, only with the pediatric population. There's women's health and midwifery, which is kind of, you know, its own beast. And there's psych NP, there's so many different outlets. And I think that is something that's not very, very well understood by people on the outside. You know, the amount of times I think too that I've said, oh, I'm a nurse practitioner. And 5 minutes later, someone's like, oh, she's a nurse. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm proud that I'm a nurse, but there are big differences. And I think, you know, when people who are on the outside and don't do these things are looking in and they hear, you know, nurse versus nurse practitioner, I actually don't really think many people understand the differences. You know, I think that for nurse practitioner, the role is very different. So instead of having, for example, in the ICU, one or two patients, you're taking care of an entire list of patients, sometimes 8 to 12 patients. As a nurse, where you're doing medication passes and doing your assessments, that, you know, those kinds of tasks, as the day-to-day as the nurse practitioner in the acute setting, you're evaluating patients' vital signs, you're examining the patient, you're looking for medical, you know, signs of decompensation, based on advanced physical examination, which you take courses on. And then you're making a plan for the patient. You're presenting the patient to the medical team, whether that's an attending physician or, a fellow, in training. You order medications, and have autonomy over that. And then I have a pretty unique role as well that I really enjoy of, doing most of the procedures.
We'll talk about that in a little while. I have actually a few questions with regard to just how different your role as an NP is in the ICU compared to that to an NP who may be at a clinic or in urgent care.
Yeah.
Or one of those other settings where they're not really performing these interventions that are fairly invasive.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like I said, I think this role was designed to allow you to specialize into a niche field in which you know, we're not doctors. We don't learn, you know, everything under the sun. We don't learn from pediatrics all the way to geriatrics. We focus in on a subset population. And something I feel very strongly, and, you know, this is kind of controversial, but I feel strongly that, you know, in order to keep nurse practitioners well-regarded, I think that in some states like Ohio, for example, if you get acute care, you practice inpatient with acute populations. If you do family nurse practitioner, you treat, you know, more in the family setting and outpatient or doing more primary care. I didn't learn, you know, if you asked me to walk into a clinic tomorrow and look in someone's ear, I didn't do any of that in school. But if you asked me to run a code or put in a central line, I can do those things. And so, you know, I think it goes both ways where, yes, there's training on the job, but I think to keep the field well-regarded, I think that's how we could best serve. And there's no clear guidelines on that right now. I think it's something that the, you know, nursing association and nurse practitioners that are kind of more in legislation are working towards in the future. But I think it is something that needs to be better carved out. And I think it would help us be more well-regarded, but it would also help people that are coming and seeking care that don't understand healthcare to feel like they have someone specialized in their care and not just the nurse is taking care of me today. I think that's something I didn't even really understand when I applied to school. It took me going through school and seeing what the training was like to feel so passionately about that.
And there's also a difference. So I don't know if you could maybe help to explain a little bit. So there's nurse practitioners, which is an advanced degree in nursing. And then you can also have just a master's degree in nursing and you're not a nurse practitioner. So I don't know if you might be able to kind of delve a little bit, just the differences there, how big they are between being an NP and then with an actual a nurse with a master's degree.
Yeah, definitely. So, the NP degree comes with a certain amount of clinical hours and training, and your courses and your education is much very geared towards, again, kind of learning how to medically manage and treat patients. A master's degree can go in a lot of different ways. You can go into management with a master's in nursing. You could go into leadership. You could go into education. There are people who go into consulting. So, the possibilities are endless with that master's degree. And I think, again, that's something where the Society of Nurse Practitioners and nursing as a whole needs to do better with identifying these differences and giving them better titles. If I say CRNA, everyone knows what a CRNA is. Everyone knows that, a certified registered nurse assistant, they've probably all dealt with one if they've ever gotten anesthesia. It's well regarded. It's well carved out. And I think, CRNAs have done a really good job for themselves of kind of carving that out and having a little more structure to what CRNA looks like. And I think there is a call to have a little bit more of that within the spectrum of NPs, because I think NPs and then, like you're saying, masters in nursing and going a different route. I think it would help everyone to understand the field a little bit more.
NPs are often thought of as being in primary care offices and clinics and even in telemedicine now. The use of NPs in hospital units, though, is something that a lot of people don't really think about or even know of. I know that really until I started working in units, I hadn't really seen a lot of NPs at the bedside, especially in the ICUs. And it seems like in ICUs, they're kind of under-recognized and underutilized. According to the American Association of Nurse Practitioners, there are nearly 400,000 nurse practitioners in the United States, but only 2.9% of those are actually in the acute care setting. That being said, I was wondering if you could speak to your role in the ICU and how it might differ from NPs that you might find working in less acute areas, such as clinics or telehealth.
Sure. So the job I have right now at BMC in the medical ICU is pretty unique. I think it's one of the luxuries of being at a teaching hospital and especially living in the Boston area where there's a lot of learners and it's pretty saturated for healthcare. So I actually have a pretty unique role there in which I help to oversee one of the teams of residents, interns. There are students, med students on the team. There can be NP students as well as fellows from other disciplines. And so in other NP jobs, such as the one I had before this one, it's pretty traditional to rotate days and nights, usually take a patient load, so somewhere from 4 to 6 of your own patients. You're going and examining them in the morning, you're creating the plan, you're presenting them to an attending physician, you're helping with procedures and writing orders, checking up on your patients throughout the day. In this role that I have now, it's a one step back from I'm still involved in direct patient care, but really acting as a liaison to all different levels. There's, resident physicians that have never been in an ICU before, or maybe they have, but they haven't seen the condition we're working with. And so that's where I get to really draw on all of my experience as a bedside nurse in the ICU for years, as well as a provider. And, I just try to help guide them. So I really kind of look at everything from the 1,000-foot view above as opposed to the nitty gritty and just make sure, suggest things if I think they might be missing something, try to pick up on cues and communicate with the nurses throughout the day, make sure we're all working as a team cohesively so we don't miss anything. Like you said, in critical care, things move very quickly. And then in this job, I also have the unique position of procedures. So pretty much anything from central lines, arterial lines, dialysis catheters, lumbar punctures, paracentesis, all different types of procedures that, again, some residents have done before, some have not. And my role there is either I'm doing those procedures independently if it's a critical situation and it is of time-sensitive matter. If we have a little bit more time and the residents want to, then I walk them through that and teach them how to do those procedures, which is really unique. And, you know, I valued learning those things when I was in school. And I think you learn best by having many different teachers and many different styles. So I really enjoy that part as well. And then the third component is helping with code. So a certain amount of times during the week, we are the code team for the hospital. And again, my role here varies different from other roles I've been in the past. In other roles and other NPs at different hospitals often help run the codes. I really act to just support wherever I need to, whether that's jumping in and putting in a central line, or maybe the resident is a little bit stunned by what's going on and needs to talk through things. Maybe the room's too loud and I'm just advocating for the nurses or some of their concerns. So I like to say I wear many hats and just try to fill in those roles. And I think it's a really unique position, but one that I wouldn't have been able to take right out of school or if I hadn't been bedside before.
Yeah. So with regard to a lot of those tasks you talk about, specifically the role of performing procedures. So a lot of people may not realize how invasive some of these procedures are. It takes a lot of training. And they're typically procedures that are done by physicians, which is why it's really unique, at least in our unit, too, that NPs have the ability and the privileges to put in these centralized catheters or do a lumbar puncture. And I was just wondering, how much training did it require after you had your NP license to actually become proficient in those skills? And was there a certain number of hours dictated by the state or the hospital or a certain number of procedures you had to perform?
Yeah, so every hospital is different. Standards can vary as far as, you know, how many procedures. I did lots of procedures in school. However, when you get hired by a hospital, none of those procedures typically count towards the amount you need at that institution itself to prove that you're eligible to perform the procedure. So while it's helpful to have the experience in the background from school, and I definitely got a lot of that experience and I think found a baseline level of comfort. I wouldn't say I went into any of my jobs feeling 100% ready to perform those procedures by myself. I think the biggest thing, like you said, is there's risks with every procedure. And, part of being a practitioner is knowing your limitations, knowing when, you know, the risks outweigh the benefits or the benefits outweigh the risks. And that's something that no matter how many of these procedures I've done, I truly do take a moment to think about before every procedure, because if you do enough, something will go wrong at some point. They're not without risk. For example, where we are now at the hospital we're at now, I believe you have to do 10 of a procedure independently, do lab work. There's a test you have to pass online, and then you're overseen and signed off. I'll tell you right now that 10 isn't enough. I teach the residents procedures pretty much every day that I'm at work. And, you know, it's all good and well when you get in and get out and the procedure goes super well. And it, not so much a complication, but, you know, not every patient's the same. So you have to use different tricks and different tips to make sure that it goes smoothly. And the residents sometimes, you know, are like, oh man, well, you had to help me with this part or that part. Those are the procedures you learn from. The ones that go smoothly from A to Z, you can do that in a lab. Anyone can be taught in a lab how to do these procedures. I don't think you need to have an MD written after your name or NP to learn these procedures. That's not what's difficult. What's difficult is having the experience and learning to adapt the procedures to keep them safe, but also successful. And I think a lot of my learning has been on the job with on-job training. So yeah, I think the big take home is when you're signed off to do these procedures, you're basically being signed off that you're safe. You understand how to do the procedure, but that does not mean by any sense that you have proficiency, but that doesn't mean you're an expert at them or that, you're the most qualified in the room. I think that comes with time and experience and failing sometimes and running into problems.
Which I think that one of the greatest points you bring up is the fact that people are different. They're different shapes, different sizes, different tolerance to sedating medications. So, you know, you can do this in a simulation lab as much as you want, but when you have, you know, 300-pound person who's, you know, obese with very little neck space and you're trying to put a catheter in.
Gotta get creative.
It's, yeah. So yeah. It's a good point to bring up and kind of interesting with regard to that.
Sorry. You know, I was just going to say, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, where does nursing come in, and, you know, PA, nursing, med school, all of those things. And not, you know, I'm never discrediting, I hope it doesn't come across that way, as a PA or a physician doesn't stop and take the time with their patients. But I do strongly feel that, you know, before every procedure, it is invasive, like you're saying, and it's not a checkbox item. These procedures aren't things that every patient should undergo for many reasons. And so I think part of being bedside and having seen so many people go through this and seeing complications or seeing the pain it can cause them, seeing all the different things, I really do try to take the time individually, either with the patient or with their family, to explain the entire procedure beyond just the level of we're going to do this, this, and this, and this is the result, and really make sure they're consentable and comfortable with what we're doing. And I think that's an important part of the NP role that I take very seriously.
Which is a good consideration, because it's not something that everybody thinks about, or at least that I've seen sometimes with when procedures are taking place. Sometimes the patient is just like a, you know, hunk of meat on the table, and yeah. It's somebody who, you know, is, even though they've consented to this, is probably very nervous if they're awake about having it done. Yeah. Another question I had, so along with those skills, NPs also have prescriptive rights. And I was wondering if you might be able to explain the process that it takes to actually complete and kind of apply for a prescription license, and how much you need to know about pharmacology. One, just you know, to get your license, and two, is there a different examination for prescriptive rights?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I think there's some nuances to prescriptive rights as far as state to state. And I do believe that in certain states, in order to renew your license every few years, you do have to do like a prescription quiz, or there's certain pharmacology CEUs and things that you need to keep up with in order to prove that you can continue to prescribe. I think this definitely also depends inpatient, outpatient, what your job is. You know, in the ICU, everyone's on fentanyl. I'm prescribing narcotics to everyone. It's probably what we end up ordering the most of, that and, you know, broad spectrum antibiotics, which are big medications that don't come without risks. It's, you know, not to be taken lightly. And so in those situations, you're often overseen by a physician. And prescriptive rights, you know, in outside practice as well, in the community, depends on what your role is. You know, if you work in a pulmonary clinic, you're probably not going to be prescribing fentanyl. So it just depends. And so the first step is getting your NP license. Once you finally have tested and gotten your NP license, you apply for prescriptive authority. Once that's approved, which again, you have to show proof that you took the required courses throughout your master's program in pharmacology. And that's usually 2 or 3 courses. And then you have to go a step further. So once you get your state license for prescriptive authority, you then have to go apply for a DEA license. And that's where you're applying for, depending on what your scope is, the ability to administer narcotics and write prescriptions for those. So it's a big process. It is pretty daunting just as far as getting through all of the steps. School does a pretty good job of setting you up so that you have all of the things you need. But the biggest thing is navigating once you get that job. What do I need there? What do I need to request? Do I need to go back to the DEA and, you know, alter, declare different prescriptive authority requests for what scheduled medications I'm going to be prescribing? And that really is job dependent.
Are there any medications that you can't prescribe?
I don't believe so. I think I have full, you know, I applied for full prescriptive authority. You know, anytime you prescribe anything, there's even things in the ICU where you have a patient come in on a medication and, you know, there's always that one off that you're like, what is this? I've never worked with this. You know, whether it's an older class drug or maybe it's a little more nuanced, or, you know, rheumatology for me is one that I'm like, I don't work with a lot of those medications. Right. I always take pause and, you know, I think the biggest thing about, you know, NP is that we are trained into it, like we discussed earlier, we are trained into a nuance, into a a smaller field. And so the most important part about being the best provider you can be is knowing your limitations. And so if it is one of those medications, that's when I take pause and I go look it up, or I always look it up, but then two, take it a step further, talk to the pharmacist, talk to other people, you know, consult our colleagues that might use those medications more. So I think, again, having full prescriptive authority also comes with the need to think intelligently about what you're prescribing. And if you're not comfortable with it, going that step further and not just saying, well, someone gave me authority, so I should just, you know, do it anyways. It's a dangerous slope if you practice that way.
So as RNs, we're obligated to participate in continuing education. It's not only a state regulation, but for those of us who have critical care certification, we also have to meet a specific number of kind of hours. So they call them contact hours to retain that certification. I was wondering, with regard to being an NP, how much continuing education does that require? And is it something you have to recertify every so many years?
Yeah, so those don't go away. I think they actually get worse. I think the difference, you know, I remember when I had to do the CEUs in nursing, it felt very broad. You could do pretty much anything that was of interest to you. For your NP, it's a little more focused. You basically create a portfolio, and this is definitely not something that you're sitting down doing, you know, two nights before it's due. It's a lot of hours. I wish I knew the exact amount off the top of my head, but not something that you're doing within a week, let alone a month. And so every 3 years and every 5 years, there's recertification processes, but essentially you should be keeping a portfolio, and a certain amount of those hours have to be related to the practice itself, excuse me. So you either have to be educating, whether that's creating PowerPoints and delivering presentations, academic presentations to your peers or otherwise. You can elect to be a preceptor. And precept, and that counts for a certain amount of hours. And so that's kind of one bucket. And then there's another bucket of pharmacology and a certain amount of CEUs. And there's a little bit of mix and match. So this is where that kind of overlap of medicine and nursing comes in, where you can get CEUs. And you also can sometimes apply some of the AMA medical credits that the physicians or PAs are also using for their accreditation process. But overall, there's like three or four different buckets. Again, one is education related, one is pharmacology related, one has to do with ethics and in all the state rights, depending on what the kind of focus is of the season. And it's pretty time consuming. I think my biggest recommendation for anyone listening that hasn't done it yet is keep a folder. And every time you do something, stick it in the folder, because the first time I kind of was like, oh, it can't be that bad. And trying to wrangle papers from 3 years ago is much more difficult than you'd anticipate. So that's a good tip, is just have a folder. And anytime you find something that intrigues you, an article or a quiz or whatever it may be, stick it in that folder and it'll make your life easier.
So the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, they project that the overall employment of nurse anesthetists, nurse midwives, and NPs is projected to grow by 38% over like the next, I think, 8 years or so. So not even over the next decade. And according to the American Association of NPs, the ranks of NPs grew at almost 10%, 8.5%, from 355,000 in 2022 to 385,000 licensed NPs in 2023. We have an aging population right now. More providers are needed everywhere, day after day. I think I have some statistics about physicians that are going to be retiring as well. And there's going to be a lot of physicians over the next 10 to 15 years who are entering retirement age and will also be leaving the profession. You kind of anticipate the roles and responsibilities of NPs are going to be expanding, and especially in the hospital setting?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, there's one thing I feel very passionately about, and I think any type of social media or otherwise this day, if you go on to, there's these heated debates where, and not everyone, because there's a lot of people who are very inclusive, but NPs who feel like they should be, you know, regarded like a physician, and physicians who feel like NPs try to think they're physicians. And my big thing is like an NP is an NP and a physician is a physician. And we can both work up into, you know, our limitations and work synergistically and help each other. But, you know, I think the concept of, you know, when I hear that, I can automatically hear people's feedback. Oh, well, if you can go to less school, and you know, people I think misconceive that more NPs doesn't mean that we would be driving out physicians, especially in places like the critical care population. I have limitations to my practice. I always will. I didn't go to medical school. It doesn't matter how many years of experience I have. And sure, I think your knowledge base grows and your comfort level with things grows, but physicians have extensive training and it's a different role. So yeah, I think the role is there for NPs. I think especially in smaller communities, again, we have a unique situation. We work in Boston. There's tons and tons of learners. NPs, PAs may or may not be disposable in those settings in the sense that there's tons of residents and med students, but that isn't universal for the country. And so, I've only ever worked as an NP in Boston, but I don't forget the fact that there's parts of the country where there might not be more than one doctor within 100 miles. And so I do think there's an expanding role, but I also think it's important for everyone on both sides to acknowledge that everyone, whether you choose to be an MD, a PA, an NP, no one's trying to take the role of the other. everyone's trying to just do their part within healthcare and work to their maximum abilities. And I think the more cohesive we can make that, the more functional, you know, we can become as a society and having those tiers of medicine. And also educating the population that's not as comfortable with working with an NP or PA. You know, so many times I hear, oh, I don't want to see the NP, not realizing that the NP is probably going to sit and talk to you longer than the doctor. Is that right or wrong? No, again, not pitting against each other, but there's a reason we have more time. If there's one doctor but four NPs, I can give you 20 minutes of my time and trusting that I'm listening and hearing everything that's important and bringing that to someone who's overseeing more people. I think the more we can get people on board with that and comfortable with that model and trusting that process and that NPs are not trying to fill the role of a physician or vice versa, I think we'd be a lot more productive as a society as far as healthcare goes.
Yeah, and so I was talking earlier about kind of physicians leaving the profession, and I actually have some statistics that burnout in the healthcare field, and this is regarding physicians, let's see, by 2034. So the Association of American Medical Colleges projects a shortage of anywhere from 38,000 to 124,000 physicians by 2034, which is 2 out of every 5 active physicians right now in the U.S. So it's going to be a huge need for these advanced care practitioners, such as NPs and PAs, after these physicians retire, to come in and help fill some of the burden.
I was going to say it's a great point. I think we can look at CRNAs and the structure of that as a good example of what NPs and the physician relationship might look like in the future. You know, a lot of places have 5 or 6 CRNAs staffed for the day with 1 or 2 attending anesthesiologists. And the CRNAs are running all of the cases and the anesthesiologist is there for backup. But the CRNAs own the cases and the anesthesiologist, again, is there as an oversight, is there as a helping hand, is there as a, someone to bounce ideas off of if it's a case that they're not as familiar with. And I think if that model that they kind of use, it sounds like that likely will probably, if that many physicians are leaving the field, be more of the push of, hey, this works really well. We bill, we pay for 2 physicians and 6 NPs. That it sounds like that's an appealing way to go with healthcare in the future from a financial standpoint and a hospital standpoint.
Yeah. And for those listening who aren't aware of what CRNA is, it's essentially, it's a nurse who has a lot of the privileges that anesthesiologists have. So they can push certain medications, they can do intubations. They're used a lot in operating rooms and also just in hospitals when they need rapid intubations of patients. So it's something that you're still a nurse, but there's a lot more schooling after that. And it's usually 2 years of very intense training to receive that kind of certification. But it definitely, yeah, it's kind of a model that would be smart to follow with regard to not replacing physicians, but supplementing physicians who are retiring.
And I think there's a big, go ahead. I think there's, you know, there's so much I could talk about on this subject because there's so many parts to it. I think, again, I work every single day with the residents and I see how hard they work. I see how many hours they work. I think that, you know, medicine is becoming a little more kind to their peers of how many hours they're working, and there's more regulations than there was, you know, maybe 10 years ago. But I think overall we, you know, as we progress as a society, people value their mental health more and it's more talked about and people value their free time. And, you know, I don't think you can cut down a medical education. I think there's a reason it's as long as it is. It's, you know, it's a very prestigious thing to be a doctor. And I don't think you can water that down by any means. But, you know, that is something I see in, you know, if I try to make sense of, you know, other than burnout, why are there less people? Well, there's other ways to practice maybe at a little less, again, like an NP. I'm not a doctor. It wasn't as much school. It fit my lifestyle more. I wanted more time out of the hospital. And there's some people who, you know, going to be a doctor is still going to fit their lifestyle, and that's totally fine. But I think other than burnout, that's another thing that people overall just want more quality of life.
And yeah, burnout. I'll touch on burnout in a minute too. I kind of want to go back to talking about your role specifically. So you're designated to a specific unit. You don't rotate. You stay in the medical intensive care unit, which is advantageous. So you get to know the policies and procedures. You get to know a lot of the staffs as well as the attending physicians. When compared to a lot of the residents who they essentially rotate through every 6 weeks or so, you get a new group that'll come in. And you might see them once or twice throughout their entire progression to obtaining their, you know, to getting through their residency and fellowship. But how much of an advantage do you feel that is to actually be on a unit where it's your unit, you stay there, just with regard to treating the patients, seeing the population that you have and kind of knowing, I don't know, almost being able to predict, you know, outcomes and how to treat those patients. Do you think that's advantageous compared to residents who might just be there for a few weeks?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, again, I think that's one of the glories of having NPs choose a sector within, and me choosing acute care is sure. Yeah. You can't put me on a pediatric unit. I don't know advanced things about pediatrics. I don't know advanced things about women's health. But I do know critical care, and I learn something every single day. And I think that is an advantage. And I think that's, you know, again, I learn from residents every single day, just as they learn from me, because they know some, you know, weird chemistry formula as to why the patient's desaturating and can teach me something. And I'm like, well, that's great, but also let's go try to save the patient. And this is what we're going to do practically. So I do think it is an advantage. I think that's one of the huge benefits of having the NP on the floor is you're allowing students to provide medical care, but with a safety net. And the patients are never jeopardized. Their care is never jeopardized because there's always someone there that, you know, will bring pause and say, hey, you're about to give this, but I've seen this before and maybe we should consider this, this, and this. And so I think, again, it's a very unique role. I think the residents work very hard. The learning curve from their first year to their third is absolutely insane. They learn just so much. But again, that medical training, that training within those few years as a resident isn't into a specialty. That's just the base of their career. That's just knowing, you know, a taste of every piece of medicine. So to expect them to come into our unit and know how to treat every single patient isn't realistic, because that's taken even myself years and years, and I'm not even a physician. So I think that's where the NP and where NPs in the hospital become so valuable is, we've seen it all. We've lived it as a nurse. We've lived it as an NP. We've seen residents coming in and out. And like you're saying, we know how it works and you recognize patterns. And so it helps for patient safety. I also think it helps for resident learning and just the overall flow of the unit.
You do a lot of instructing and teaching in your role. Do you ever feel that sometimes the physicians either don't take you seriously, or that maybe there's not as much respect because you are a nurse and you're not a physician, you didn't go to med school? Or do you feel that they're usually pretty receptive to what you actually have to tell them and teach them?
You know, I think there's always the one-off, but globally, I think it also has a lot to do, you know, you have to look back at yourself and your own ego. And there's always going to be people who feel the need to make it known who they are compared to you. But, you know, I think earlier in my career, I was more worried about that. I was more worried about making suggestions and maybe them being shot down or feeling like I, you know, had to prove something. I think I've become more confident in, again, I love saying, I know what I know and I know what I don't know. And that's where I'm going to ask for help. And I think you earn respect from people by practicing that way, because I don't get myself into situations where I'm trying to overextend myself. I go use my physicians that know the things I don't know. And I think that just takes time. I think I've seen the trend over the years of that they have more trust in me. And, you know, at the beginning it was like, they're checking in every minute. And then, you know, 4 years from now, sometimes I see them in the morning. And then the next thing is at the end of the day, and we've had a crazy day, but I've been able to take care of it all and report back to them. And they have the trust in me that if I need them, I will call them. We're all humans and we all need a different amount of control. And so again, checking your own ego of some people just need control and that has no reflection on me. That's just how they manage a team has been really helpful. But I would say globally speaking from your own team, the respect is there. I think what can be more challenging is working with other teams who maybe don't work with NPs as much or maybe have had bad experiences with NPs. There's bad in every field, but I think sometimes that sour taste is people are quick on a consulting team, you know, to you're asking them questions and they're quick to turn and direct their question towards the physician. It is unique, but sometimes I'm like, you know what, if you want to ask the intern who's been here for 3 days, what's wrong with the patient, by all means, go ahead. And then when you're done and you don't get your answers, I'm happy to help. So, and I think that's how, again, just patience and grace with, I used to get more upset about it of, you know, I now think, well, they clearly have a conception in their head of, or a misconception in their head of what my role is here. And just time and consistency and continuing to show up and make the right calls and communicate effectively. I kind of just try to hope that my work speaks for itself in recurrent patterns of working with the same people, they find more respect for either me or NPs in general.
Do you enjoy the educational aspect of being an NP?
I do. Yeah. I think if you ever get bored at your job or you think that it's not for you or you know everything you need to know, precept someone, whether you're a nurse, whether you're literally whatever field you're in, if you're hitting a wall, bring someone on who knows less than you, because there is nothing like the questions they come up with. My brain, again, is stimulated every single day because I'll say, oh, we need to give this medication. And they'll say, well, why? What mechanism does that work on? I'm like, I don't know. I knew that 7 years ago, but I just know that's what we give. And I know that's what's going to help the patient. You know, and then we go back together. We figure it out. It refreshes your brain. They learn something. You learn something. So, yeah, I think the teaching is great. I think it's inevitably what keeps you from, you know, stasis in your job or plateauing in your learning. And it has its days because, again, the residents change every 3 weeks. So sometimes you're explaining the same things every 3 weeks for years on end. But other times you learn things that are completely invaluable and it's just day to day.
So with regard to burnout, the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, they reported that approximately 100,000 RNs left the workforce during COVID-19. This was due to stress, burnout, and retiring. And they projected another 610,000 RNs reported with the intent to leave the workforce over the next 5 years, so by 2030. And this is also due just to stress and burnout and retirement. The ICU, it's extremely stressful and very overwhelming. Have you ever felt the need or the desire to actually leave the ICU and try and find something that's just a little less hectic?
You know, Andy, we could make an entire podcast just about burnout because I have a lot of opinions on it. I feel pretty passionately about it. I think there's ebbs and flows of burnout. And honestly, if you ask me if during COVID I was burnt out, I actually, you know, it was probably the most stimulated I ever was because every patient was so sick. I found a way to compartmentalize the amount of death we saw. And I think that for some people is what took them out is just like holding so many people's hands and watching people die alone and FaceTiming their families. And that was its own bear that I think, you know, people need to address in their own time. But at the same time, I was actually able to leave and feel like, wow, that was a really cruddy situation, but I did something of meaning today and I did something purposeful while people were, you know, at home baking bread for a year. And there's nothing wrong with that, but like I found purpose in that. I felt stimulated. Everyone was sick. I felt like I'm doing something every day to make a difference. And so I actually think my fatigue and burnout was the lowest then. But again, I say that because I chose acute care. I went into acute care knowing from the start, this is what stimulates me. This is my wheelhouse. This is what I'm passionate about. And so I actually, you know, I think the burnout doesn't come from critical care. I think the burnout that nurses are feeling comes from hospitals being run like businesses, from management and objectives and, you know, agendas being forced that have nothing to do with providing the best care for the patients and rather about a checklist or CME requirements or, you know, whatever it is, JCO requirements, sorry, not CME. But so I think that's the first part of burnout is it used to be about being at the bedside as much as you could and nurturing the patients. And somewhere in the last 5 to 7 years, I feel like that has shifted to, oh, that's great that you, you know, sat with your crying patient, but have you charted yet? And that's fatiguing, especially for nurses. Everyone in nursing is there to care for people. So you're asking people who have an exceptional amount of compassion and empathy for humans to essentially remove themselves from that to tick off boxes. And none of us signed up for that. So that's the first problem with burnout. You know, the second problem is medicine is advancing and we can do a heck of a lot more now than we could do 15 years ago, 10 years ago. But what are the limitations to that? Again, I love being in the ICU. I love taking care of critically ill patients. But what will burn me out someday is keeping people alive beyond their means and feeling like we're torturing them or not honoring their wishes. And we're keeping a body alive, but, you know, only with machines. And I think we haven't learned as providers yet, and maybe it's a legal thing, it's multifactorial. Again, we would need a whole podcast, but I don't think we've learned yet when it's okay to say, no, this isn't in the patient's best interest, and that be okay. There's very few providers who are okay with saying, you know what, we could offer this therapy, but they're still not going to live, and it's going to prolong their suffering. And I think that's hard on nurses. It's hard on me as a provider to ask the nurses to keep doing things when they're in the room and patients are begging them to stop or they're screaming in pain. And I don't have a solution for that. I think there's a bigger call to arms, again, for all of these different agendas and burnout. But if I burn out, it will be related to external factors like those and not so much the critical care itself.
Good to know. And I'm all about doing a podcast on burnout with you. Like, I would love to go down the rabbit hole of what causes it, what, you know, what we can do to fix it and how it's inevitably probably going to get worse.
100%.
With coming nursing shortages, once again, an aging population. And as you said, we can keep people alive longer with medications, but quality of life for those people, often they stay in the hospital for the last months of their lives while they slowly, slowly die. And they might go to a rehab facility and get a bad pneumonia, come back and die in the hospital. It's a bad cycle.
Angry these days. I would love to hear other people's opinions listening to this, but I get yelled at more by patients and patients' families in the last 2 or 3 years than I had in almost 10 years in the field. And I talk about this at work. I talk about this at home. I don't know what that shift was. I don't know if it was mistrust after COVID or people realized they could advocate for their care more, which is great. People should be advocating for their care. I can't pinpoint it. And I would love for people listening to, you know, explore that with us because there is something bigger there. And, you know, you get more bees with honey than you do with vinegar, but that's just not how it is in the hospital anymore. It's who can yell the loudest, who can cause the biggest scene. And that is what's distressing. That is what causes burnout for myself, for the nurses, for everyone. And I don't think it's just in healthcare. I think in humanity in general, the last few years have just become a little more rough around the edges and chip on people's shoulders. So, yeah, no, maybe in 20 years, we'll see some post-COVID data on this, but.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I think, kind of anger and resentment and COVID. It made a lot of people angry. A lot of people lost loved ones, or they got sick, or they couldn't go to work. They couldn't kind of send their kids to school. Who knows what it was? And it was extremely polarizing. And it and being in healthcare, you're just associated with COVID-19 just because, you know, you are in healthcare. So it's like, I don't know. It's
yeah. And you went from like, oh, the healthcare heroes to people, you know, shouting at you and having no trust in your judgment or the things that you're suggesting for, you know, for as far as care for their loved one. And it's a hard juxtaposition to have the two. You know, when we were needed the most, we were getting praise. We're still very much needed, but it's a different bear lately. And I don't think anyone in our field leaves the field because they're tired of helping people. They're tired of all the surrounding factors that truly do, like, you leave and you're tired emotionally, physically.
Yeah. And it's, I totally agree with your point too, of a lot of the frustration comes from, a lot of times people who are in, I wouldn't even say management positions, but more of the, kind of hospital directors, people who aren't actually healthcare professionals, but are in a role where they can kind of dictate who gets what for funding, where resources go to. And it's a lot of times the people who end up getting hurt the most are actually the nursing units, because when they cut back funds, they'll cut back, you know, they'll shortchange us on supplies, they'll buy cheaper supplies, they won't buy enough. And then COVID ruined a lot of hospital systems too. It bankrupted a lot, as we're seeing now. You know, there's local hospital systems here in Boston that just recently kind of went bankrupt and had to be bought out by other hospitals. And this is happening all over the country, but that's for another day. I'd love to get into that topic. So in the ICU, we have three different teams to cover. I think we have a total of 27 different beds, and it's split up, usually evenly among the three teams. And two of those teams will have fellows. So a fellow is a third or fourth year doctor who is essentially, some days they'll be the ones who kind of lead the rounding, and they'll eventually move on to either be an attending physician or go into a different kind of practice. But one of our teams has NPs, and the NPs do a lot of what our fellows do. So the procedures, they do a lot of the educating the residents, and they're essentially used as a fellow in that scenario. Do you know of any other units or hospitals that kind of have that same type of, I guess, the same type of model, using NPs instead of fellows?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think I mentioned earlier, it's kind of a unicorn of a job as far as I know. I'm sure they're out there, but again, in a situation where a lot of places in the country either don't have an education program or a med school program tied to their hospital, or the hospital needs essentially, you know, a cheaper way than having a bunch of attending physicians, if it's a non-education hospital, whatever the reasons, I think the majority of jobs for NPs and PAs in acute care, usually you're rounding days and nights, usually you're covering the list overnight, over the day, kind of working more in that resident role of managing the patients, getting your own patient list, and providing that direct care. Again, I do provide the direct care, but that education piece and the procedure piece is definitely unique. And it's nice, you know, there's the fellows come and go again too. They are there for a month and then they rotate onto other things they need to learn and then they come back. And so while I'm not on the other two teams, we are the constant for the unit. And so I try to poke my head in. I try to make sure they don't need any help, try to support them, be a sounding board, you know, and just help them gain confidence. It's a scary role to put their feet into and have those new responsibilities. And, you know, especially in the beginning of their year, I really try to be there in case they're like, hey, I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think? And really try to promote their learning and give them the confidence that, yeah, that's a good idea. Go for it. So I think it goes beyond our team. But no, I don't know of other... at least in this area, I haven't heard of it.
So the U.S. News and World Report ranked the NP role as the one of the best draws to help people. And it also ranked it first on its list of the 2023 best healthcare jobs list. For those who are listening and they're either currently in the nursing profession, maybe they're in nursing school or thinking about going to nursing school, what advice would you have with regard to pursuing your NP? Would you recommend that they do some time at the bedside or figure out exactly what specific kind of area they'd like to work in?
Yeah, so I think we talked about it earlier that I and this is, again, hot take, controversial, but I don't think you should be going back to NP school. It wasn't, it didn't originate this way. I think that it, again, became a monetized thing about let's make these NP factories of blowing through, you know, a dual program of RN and NP. The whole point of NP is that you have nursing experience that you can draw on, and that gives you that, those extra hours and all of that. So I wouldn't go straight through. I also think that a couple years at the bedside, your opinions on things change, the unit you might want to work on might change. So you're kind of pigeonholing yourself if you think, oh, I'm just going to get it done and go straight through. You're not actually cutting any time off, because you run the risk that you're going to go straight through and then in 3 years realize, oh, I actually wanted to do X, Y, Z, and I have no experience in it. So that's the first thing. Time's going to go by whether you're there or not. So enjoy the ride and try to really, you know, hone in on what is going to give you the most longevity, and make sure that you have bought into that before you put time and money in going back to school. I think that's the first part. The second part is, it's really hard to know what's out there. I wish there was a more carved out way. I always say this, a more carved out way to be a liaison to people who are nurses or people who are thinking about going back to school. You have this idea, okay, I want to go back to school, and you go on Google and the options seem like, okay, well, I can either, if I'm a nurse, I can either become an NP, a CRNA, or go into management. And there's so much more out there than that. My recommendation is, if you're going to go back to school and you're going to do NP, and make sure that you want to do NP for the right reasons. And I don't think getting away from the bedside is the right reason. And I think that's why a good amount of people do it. But the reality of that is that you will get away from the bedside, and then you will just have a whole new slew of problems when you're an NP. You know, the grass is not just greener just because you're away from bedside. You're still dealing with a lot, if not all, of the bedside problems and then some. So make sure it's really the career that you want for other reasons other than you're burnt out from nursing. And really explore the options. It's not just NP or CRNA. It's not just management or education. There's legal consulting. It's truly endless what you can do. I think that often some people see it as, I got to get away from bedside, which I understand, people burn out, but you will burn out no matter what field you choose if you're not confident in your decision.
Would you do anything differently if you had to go back from the beginning and start over again? Are you happy with the path that you've taken?
Yeah, that's a great question. I wouldn't. I am very happy. Again, we have our days. Like there are days where I feel burnt out. There are days where I do question, you know, ethically, morally, all of these things that we've discussed, burnout. Can I do this for 30 more years? But, you know, when you take a step back and look at the day to day, I love my job. I love feeling like I get to work with nursing. I get to work with doctors. I get to help patients. I the more experience you get to be a voice of reason in the room. And those are all really good feelings and very satisfying. And I don't have any regrets. I think I had discussed earlier, I had contemplated PA, I had contemplated med school. I finally have gotten to a point in my career where I do go home and I think, you know what, I have the life balance, work-life balance that I planned on. And that can't go unrecognized either. So I wouldn't do anything different. I'm content with the path. It was a long one. And in the time, you know, when you're going through it, again, I said time passes no matter what, but when you're going through it, you think, oh, there's no way I can, you know, be bedside for another year. There's no way I can get through another year of school and work full time, but it is possible. And eventually you wake up one day and you're 6 years into NP and still loving it and learning. So,
Artificial intelligence, it's being used a lot in every aspect of life and being introduced in healthcare in various ways. Have you heard of any ways of AI being used in areas of practice that might be beneficial to, you know, NPs or physicians? Do you use any kind of AI in your practice?
Oh, gosh. Well, you're talking to someone who, you know, my solution to technology not working is like, did you turn it off and turn it back on again? So I am not the most tech savvy person. However, a lot of the residents we work with, and again, I don't have it, so I don't know the name of it. OpenAI, I can't even guess, but they do have an AI software that you can type in, you know, show me the resources for pneumonia, and it'll actually bring up peer-reviewed journal articles and the most recent articles related to pneumonia and how to treat it and whatever research is going. I think that's a great way. I think that's a great way to utilize AI. What I don't think is a great way to utilize AI is, you know, type up my care plan for my patient with, you know, diabetes. I'm sure that's out there. I'm sure there's people who use it, but again, it's coming from someone who like hand wrote all of her notes and yeah, papers.
There's benefit to doing the work yourself. That's how you learn, especially when in medicine and healthcare, like you need to actually get your hands dirty. You can't let a computer do the work for you.
Yeah. You know, and that's the thing is that if you choose to be in medicine, you're not choosing a life of cutting corners. Like there are 100 other fields that you can go into and make probably 3 times more money and work 30 times less hard. So anyone going into medicine isn't doing it for like the financial gain. And I think you have to go into it knowing how hard you're going to work. And so, again, you're only doing yourself a disservice. I think there are going to be good ways to use it. I think I'm sure there's going to be ways to even help patients and help educate patients about their health conditions or, you know, discharge instructions. I'm sure there's a role for it. But like with anything, I think in moderation and again.
One last question for you. Do you watch any medical television shows? And if you do, which is your favorite and why?
Oh, I don't. I think back in the day I watched Grey's Anatomy because it was fun to like laugh, you know, when the oxygen probe was like in their ear or whatever. But I don't. I remember before I was in, I think probably while I was in nursing, I would watch like Untold Stories of the ER and I loved the adrenaline of it. And again, I hadn't had enough exposure where I just felt like I couldn't get enough. But now I very much, I've had my fair share of codes. I've had my fair share of people bleeding out in lines and medical mysteries. And again, I try to keep my learning and compartmentalize that to work and to try to enjoy other hobbies and other shows and things outside of work.
Well, Taylor, thank you so much for coming on and discussing your role, especially, like you said, it's a very unique role as a, you know, NP in the ICU and one that'll probably be, you know, utilized more in the future. And then if you ever want to do a burnout podcast and discuss the various reasons, I am more than happy to explore that with you. So
yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's nice to share again. Like, sometimes I feel like I'm in this unicorn job that people don't really know about, and I'm there every week, but the role is not very recognized or highlighted. So it's nice to share and allow people to hear what the possibilities are out there. So
awesome. Thank you so much, Taylor. Again, everybody, if you have any questions, comments, any suggestions for shows, can be reached at Make Me Sick Pod on X and makemesickpod@gmail.com. Taylor, thank you again. I hope you have a wonderful afternoon and I'll see you at work.
Thank you so much.
Stitching up lives in the ICU. Threads of hope in her hands, so true. Leading cold, she saves the day. Teaching residents as they find their way. Needles and hearts, she works with grace. Every patient's life, she won't misplace. Busy nights, but she stands tall. In critical moments, she midnight calls, she patches lives and mends the flaws. In the chaos, she remains calm, a guiding light, a healing balm. Beyond the scrubs and late night shifts, she gives her all in endless gifts. Every detail she perfects, in the ICU she protects. Her all and endless gifts, every detail she perfects, in the ICU she protects, tailoring dreams and